Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Smell Podcast. I'm your host, Katie Boateng. This week, join me in listening to a conversation with Alexandra Petrella, an anosmic living in Tucson, Arizona. We talk about how she believes she acquired anosmia when she was very young, her own anosmia story, including her scent detection and alert service dog named Oliver. I was very excited to speak with her and learn more about her own story, including how she began working with Oliver and his training. I know many listeners would be interested in having their own service animal to assist them with smelling, so listen in to find out all about it. Our interview was recorded in October 2021. Let's listen in. Hi, Alexandra. Welcome to the Smell Podcast. How are you doing?
I am doing good. How are you?
I'm doing really well. I'm excited to talk to you. Can you start off by telling us a little bit about yourself? Like, where are you from and where do you live now, if it's different?
Sure. So I am 21. I was born in Denver, Colorado, but we moved to Goodyear, Arizona when I was about 5 years old because of dad's work. And then about maybe 5 or 6 years ago now, we moved down to Tucson, Arizona. So that's where we're currently living.
Nice. 21. I feel like you might be the youngest Smell Podcast guest that I've talked to so far. That's pretty cool.
Oh, really? Cool.
Yeah. So what do you do now? Like work or school?
So currently I am a bather for a dog groomer down in Vail, but I will be starting community college in the spring. So I'm looking forward to that too.
Oh, that's great. I actually did my master's degree in Colorado at Colorado State University, but online.
Ooh. That's one of my colleges that I might go to after community college.
Nice. That's awesome. Yeah. So, Alexandra, I wanted to speak with you today because you have a unique story. So let's start off. What is your anosmia story?
So my anosmia story is probably when I was about like 4 or 5, mom would take me to like the Bath and Body Works stores and have me smell candles and soaps and stuff. And we noticed that my responses were always, "What do you mean smells? What smells that?" Or what, all stuff like that. And so from there, like, my parents kind of thought it was kind of weird, but then they didn't really think much of it after that until I started becoming more persistent in the fact that I'm like, I can't smell what you guys are talking about. So they took me to a children's ENT, and the ENT was like, "Yeah, she can't smell. Some kids are like that, some aren't." And so I was kind of very like depressed and disheartened about that fact when I was told. And so from there, we kind of just went on with my life. And then until kind of recently, about maybe 5 years ago, we went back to the ENT for a different problem. And he was like, "Oh, you can't smell." I'm like, "Yeah." And he asked for a recent MRI that I had done. And he looked at it and he was like, "Oh, the nerves that connect from your olfactory bulb to your brain look like they died at some point and never regenerated or healed." So he said that usually happens whenever you have like a head injury or if you got really sick or something, and mine just never recovered. He said based on how it looked on the MRI, it could have been when I was like an infant to a toddler. So we are guessing that I acquired my anosmia when I was very, very young.
That's interesting. So I'm wondering, was this the same ENT that you saw when you were like a little child?
No, it's a different one. The first one was we got done. It was like a children's, like Phoenix Children's Hospital type one. Mm-hmm. And then the other one was more like an adult ENT.
Gotcha. Okay, so with that, so you grew up having anosmia as far as you know, since you were really little. So I guess at like what age, you talked about like the Bath and Body Works stores, and I can remember how those were very, very smelly because I used to have a sense of smell as well. But I guess at like what age did you really figure out that you couldn't smell? Like when did it actually click for you that like, oh wow, this is something that I don't have that other people do? Because it's such kind of a subjective experience.
Yeah, it is. Like I noticed it then, but I didn't really like click until I was probably in fourth grade. So I was probably what, 8 or 9 years old when we were doing science projects. And one of them was to smell what was in these tubes and write down your answers. And I was like, I can't do this. And the teacher's like, "What do you mean you can't do it?" I'm like, "I can't give you what you want me to tell you because I don't know the smells." And so we're kind of like, "Oh, that's kind of concerning, and that's kind of like, that's not normal. And so that's kind of what brought more of the attention to it in my life. I was like, oh, okay, yeah, that's something that we need to look into more.
Yeah, and then with that in mind, kind of growing up knowing that you were different, right, that you didn't have a sense of smell, is that something that you typically shared with people, or did you keep it to yourself?
It also depended, depending on if, like, it was brought up in, like, normal conversation, like, if someone was saying, like, they smelled something really good, I'd be like, what do you mean? And they're like, oh, it's like this. I'm like, oh, I can't smell. And then so they would kind of, like, describe it a little bit, and then we would talk about it. But otherwise, I wouldn't really say, like, oh, I can't smell that, unless it was, like, really brought up in the conversation.
I see. So it wasn't, like, your fun fact at parties or anything?
Not until recently. Not until I got more used to it and all that, yeah.
Oh, man, that's my go-to fun fact. So you mentioned you work for a dog groomer, so I'm imagining that you have a love of dogs. So I wanted to speak with you specifically, first off, because you do have anosmia, but also because you have a special dog in your life. So can you please tell us a little bit about your scent detection and alert service dog? First off, what is his or her name?
Of course. So his name is Oliver. Okay. He is 5.5 years old, and he's a little Shih Tzu.
So I mentioned he's a scent detection and alert service dog. So basically, how did this happen? How did you come about having a service pet like this, or a service animal?
So Oliver, he does these scent alerts and smells. So his tasks are essentially to smell something that I give him to smell, and he will detect if it's gone bad or not. For instance, we do one with spoiled goat's milk. So I'll have him smell the goat's milk, and he will decide if it is bad or not, and he will give me an alert to tell me if it is. And so we came to that in our journey of as a team by, when I was, you know, I was younger, my dad used to travel for work, and he found a dog on one of his flights who was going to his new handler, and the lady told my dad that, yeah, the dog does these scent detection tasks for this new owner, and because the owner can't smell. And so from there, it kind of stuck with me. I'm like, oh, this is something that I can get into when I'm older. And so whenever I started getting older, I was like, okay, this is something I want to do. And so I looked into it. I couldn't really find any organizations or anything that train dogs specifically for people with anosmia. But I ended up contacting a couple of professional breeders in my area, and one got back to me saying, yeah, we can totally do this. It's similar to like bomb detection and drug detection dogs. So they teach it a similar way. It's just with a different smell. And so from there, I ended up getting Oliver, and then I brought Oliver to the trainer, and we did like a little eval thing to make sure Oliver was the right temperament for the work. And within, I think, 3 months, we got him into training just for basic stuff. And then from there, he ended up learning more advanced stuff. And then probably around, I think it was a year old, he started his official scent training.
So it sounds like it took you a while to figure out someone who could actually assist you. So when he started his official scent training, that sounds like it's really specialized. So was this a person training him that usually trained like bomb sniffing or drug sniffing dogs? I'm just fascinated with kind of the backstory. Like, how did you find that person?
So I found, his name is Sean Thompson. He is one of the owners of Top Dog Boarding and Training in Gilbert, Arizona. And I found him just by Googling different professional trainers in Phoenix. And he is one of those that came up, and I emailed back and forth with him for probably a good couple of months, telling him what I was looking for. And he was like, yeah, we've trained bomb sniffing dogs, drug sniffing dogs. He's also trained other, like, there's a sport called IPO, which is kind of like bite work type of thing. And he's like, we've done different type of trainings with all these different dogs. Dogs come from all over the country to see him, to get trained. So I'm like, this is kind of a good person to have training a service dog. And so we kind of stuck with him, and I'm glad that we did.
That's awesome. So you mentioned that Oliver's able to help you detect if something has gone bad. And one example was you gave was the goat's milk. So how many, when you're training him, do you have to train him for each specific item, or could you train him to detect bad odors in a bunch of different items at one time, if that question makes sense?
Yeah, so when you train it, you have to train it individually, but once he knows them, he'll be able to alert to any of them. So right now, Oliver only knows three scents to look out for, because I had to kind of stop his scent training and move on to some other tasks whenever I learned I had different diagnoses. And so at the time when I was doing his scent training, he first learned his wild goat's milk alert. So actually, Sean helped us with that. He did some board and training with them. And he was there for, I think, 2 months to first learn the first one. I just needed him to learn how to use his nose as how a detection dog should, because normal dogs, while they can smell really good and better than humans can, not all breeds are specifically going to use their nose to do stuff. And Shih Tzus aren't really known for their noses, like say like maybe a poodle or like a bloodhound or something like that. So they teach him how to use his nose to detect the difference between whenever the goat's milk was good to bad. That like slight little like gray area is where he was trained to alert to. And then after he learned that one, the next year we worked on sulfur for like gas leaks. So the sulfur smell is what gives the natural gas leaks the like rotten egg type smell. So they had to actually special order like Hollywood Effects sulfur smell from California for Oliver to learn how to smell it and detect, which I thought was really cool, because I was like, oh, he's getting up there with all of his scent training, and he has to get some special things ordered because it's not something common to find.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
I'm interested in learning a little bit more about what's actually involved in the training. So you're talking about like they teach him to alert to a smell and then to tell you about it. So what does that look like, I guess? Does that mean like each time he smells it, they give him like a cookie to award him, or I guess kind of what's involved a little bit more in the actual training to identify the smell, if you know?
So for scent detection, it's more like they have to, because they get their nose to figure out whether they're smelling something. So for instance, with Oliver's sulfur detection, they put little like cotton balls with the sulfur scent on them, and like these little, like, you know, little plastic containers that you get for salsa or stuff at restaurants, something mm-hmm. like that. And so they put some holes in the top of the lid, and they'd have the ball, the cotton ball that has a scent on it in there, and then they'd put it in front of his nose and have him sniff it. And once he started sniffing it, they would reward him for it. Mm. And slowly they would lessen the rewards and have him start distancing himself from the smell and having to go smell around the room to find it. And once he found it, he would like sniff it enough, and then they'd tell him, yes, good boy. Give him a treat, and then from there they have to make him alert to it. So when we find it, he'd have to bark and lay down as his alert. So he will sniff around the room, find the scent, and then he will bark and lay down. And so that's essentially how it works. But each step will take multiple repetitions for the dog to learn it properly.
That's fascinating. So in your day-to-day life, do you have to prompt him to alert you, or does he just alert you if he smells it?
It's kind of a mix of it. It depends on what it is. Like for our goat's milk alert, I will show him the carton and open the cap and let him take a sniff of it. And then he will decide if it's good or not. And then if he doesn't give me an alert, he'll usually kind of either look at me or just kind of walk away. And that's it's okay to drink one. Mm-hmm. Or if it's bad, he will totally lay down and bark. There's sometimes he will have like a kind of, he's not quite sure, because there is a weird time frame with goat's milk where one day it could be good, and the next day it could be bad. But my parents told me that the smell sometimes will kind of revert back to smelling all right. So if I miss that weird window, all of a sudden think it's still good. So that's why I always still end up taste it or have one of my parents still smell it to double check his work. Mm-hmm. And then he'll be confused and go, is it correct or am I wrong? What's going on here, Mom?
Yeah, so for sure.
Pretty much almost on a daily basis. But for his sulfur detection for the gas leaks, he actually has done that one on his own before. We came home from like a movie or something, and one of the family members didn't turn the stove all the way off before we left. Mm. So there was a little bit of a gas smell in the house, and we walked from the garage into the hallway, and he stopped and kind of backed up and barked at me. And then one of my family members came behind me, like, oh, it smells like sulfur in here, gas in here. And so me and Oliver immediately walked out of the house as a reward for him, as saying, good job, you did good. And then my parents walked it out of the house.
That's amazing. I'm sure a lot of people listening, myself included, would love to have this kind of option in our lives, you know, being anosmic and not having the ability to smell things. It would be really cool to have, and I like dogs in general, so it would be really cool to have a dog around who could help me in like this day-to-day task.
Yeah, it's definitely like an extra like little bit of security, because I had an instance when I first actually got Oliver before he was even trained. He was still, I think, maybe 3 or 4 months old, and I was home alone making dinner, and the dinner called for it to be put in the oven for, I think, 20 minutes. And as soon as I set the timer, I heard one of the dogs getting sick in the other room, and I went over there to clean it up, and about maybe 5-10 minutes into the cook time, I just had this really strong urge to go check on the dinner, and I look up, and there's smoke coming from the oven, and I did not know it this whole time, and so I got up and ran over there, turned the oven off, opened the oven door, opened the back door, started wafting smoke out. And that was kind of like when we're like, oh, this could be dangerous, because our smoke detectors did not go off. And they were literally in the next room. They had fresh batteries, all of that. And there was smoke going right to them and nothing come from them. So I was like, that was kind of a really scary moment for me. And that kind of helped reassure my parents that this is a thing that we should be doing with a dog type of thing.
Yeah. So I guess my next question that comes up for me is, do you foresee him ever being done being trained for smells, or slowly but surely you plan to add more smells to his repertoire?
I do plan on adding at least one more. I do want him to, be able to detect and alert to a house fire, smoke and fire smell. Mm-hmm. Just so whenever I move out, I feel more secure with him. But besides that, he will be done with his scent smells. And he knows probably about maybe 20 different tasks in total. His scent ones are just a small part of his training. So I feel very comfortable with him, how he is in mm-hmm. his service journey. And he probably will be retiring in maybe 3 or 4 years. So I don't want to put too much more on him.
Gotcha.
But it honestly depends, for each dog and each team, how long a service dog continues to work for. But I'll be glad if Oliver continues wanting to work for the next 4 years.
That's awesome. So one thing that we had talked about a little bit via email that I just wanted to make sure I ask you about on this conversation is, what kind of training is involved to become certified as a service dog?
So for service dogs in at least America, there is really actually no certification or registration required for service dogs. I know in some other countries they do have it mandatory, but in the US we do not. So it's kind of hard for some people to realize that you don't need those things for your dog to be a service dog. What makes a service dog is its training. So depending on what a person needs from the dog, a dog could really only have to perform one task for it to be considered a service dog, and or up to like as many tasks as you need the dog to be able to perform. But besides that, it depends, like I said, it depends on what the dog needs to learn. That varies in the training. So with Oliver's training, he had to do basic obedience training, some advanced obedience training before he even started his service dog training. And in that, it all comes down to like access training, to go into public and stuff like that, being exposed to different animals, people, sounds, environments like that. And that will help solidify them whenever they're out in public with their new handler, that they are a solid dog.
Yeah, I think a lot of people may not know that there's not like a certificate, or there's not like a test that all dogs have to take to pass. It's very individualized is what it sounds like.
Yeah, and it definitely is kind of a hard thing whenever service dog handlers go into public, because there's that misconception that there needs to be paperwork. There are access issues that happen. So a restaurant could say, oh, where's your papers or your certification or ID or something like that, that is not legally required in the U.S. It can make the handler and service dog have an access issue, and they can't go to that place because the management is bent on having to have those things, because teams in the past have shown them, but those things that they've shown the management aren't legitimate. They're kind of scams. There's ways for companies to make money off of people who want to bring their dogs in public.
So I'm fascinated by Oliver, but I kind of want to dive into a little bit more about you and your own anosmia story. So kind of switching gears a little bit, I want to ask you, do you think that being anosmic impacts your relationship with food and eating in any way?
I think it does. I have definitely been a picky eater since I was a little. And when I think about it, it's probably been because of my anosmia. But I know, can we all eat with our eyes, in addition to like people who can smell, they use their nose. But with me, I notice I rely more and more on my eyes when I'm eating. And if something doesn't look appetizing to me, even though it could probably smell delicious, I won't touch it.
Mm-hmm.
Unless like, maybe like I've had it before, or like I just happen not to look at the food and eat it right away, and then I'll know what it is, and then I'll eat it in the future. But I am very picky with what I eat because I know I can't smell it. So I'm just like, I always rely on my eyes. And it's kind of hard that you could be missing out on a really good meal whenever you can't smell it.
Yeah, I actually just had an incident recently where, to your point, we do eat with our eyes for sure. And having anosmia, I think we, what's the word I'm looking for? We cope differently, or accommodate maybe, yeah, is the word I'm looking for. So I had like turkey meat in like lunch meat, and mm-hmm. it just didn't look right. Like the date looked fine, or the date was fine, but it just didn't look right. Like it looked kind of slickery. And I was like, I don't think this is right. So I actually asked my husband to smell it for me, and he was like, yeah, don't eat that. So to your point, I think we get better at like making accommodations for ourselves of like visually inspecting our food.
Oh yeah, definitely. That's like a hard thing to do, especially whenever it's maybe like a food that you can't visually look at to see if it's all right. Like I know mm-hmm. like for milk, for instance, you can't always tell right away if it is bad, because in the jug, and unless you're like pouring it out and you see the chunks in it, or like the discoloration, you don't really know until it's too late.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So this next question I like to ask all the guests who come on, and there's no right or wrong answer. I'm just curious in your thought process, but what do you think about anosmia as a disability? Do you self-identify as having a disability due to your anosmia?
I do. I mean, I do have several other disabilities, but anosmia was my first diagnosis as what I would consider as a disability, because it does hinder me in my day-to-day life, because I'm not enjoying things as much as I know I could be. And I know some people don't think it is an asthma as a disability, but because like maybe it's not like it's not visible or they don't consider it as a big deal. But I know the definition of disability is a physical or mental condition that limits a person's movement, senses, or activities. And while it may not be as disabling to some as it is to others, people need to acknowledge that it is a valid disability because we're living without one of our senses. And like, you wouldn't tell like a deaf or a blind person that their disability isn't valid because they can't see or hear. So why is it different for people with anosmia? Like, why don't we have that validity being acknowledged?
Yeah, I 100% agree with you. It's actually Invisible Disabilities Week, and there's the Invisible Disabilities Association, which is an organization in the U.S. to raise awareness about invisible disabilities, and they're currently celebrating Invisible Disabilities Week. So
I know. I like how it's a cool thing. I have my calendar every year as it comes up, and I'm like, yes, I can explain things to people and show. I can have awareness for it. Like I think last year on my Instagram and Facebook, I posted each day of some of my invisible disabilities and explaining what each one kind of was and how it affects me. And it's kind of cool seeing the response.
Yeah, absolutely. So if anyone is listening and hasn't checked out invisibledisabilities.org, make sure you go and take a look at what they're doing in their work. And yeah, it's October 17th through the 23rd is celebration of Invisible Disabilities Week. So I'm glad you're aware of it and are celebrating it and did that last year. That's really cool. So my next question for you is, what do you want people who don't have anosmia or a smell disorder to know about what it's like living with it?
I would like people who don't have anosmia actually to like, believe us when we tell you that we can't smell something. Like, don't just brush it off and say it's like allergies or cold, because it's not. It's, we deal with it every day, and it affects us. And they sort of just assume that because we can't smell, that we can't taste either. Like, I know it's kind of a big misconception that people go, oh, you can't smell, so it means you can't taste. I'm like, no, I can taste my food. I just may be more picky about it because I lost one sense, so the other senses kind of come out more. So please don't assume that. But I'm more than happy to like educate you on the matter, but don't just assume that.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. If you could have a sense of smell again, would you want one?
Honestly, probably not. I'm so used to not being able to smell, and I think it would just be very overwhelming if I did, especially now being 21 and not smelling. Maybe I was like maybe a year old or 2 years, so it would just be very, very overwhelming. But I don't know, maybe like if there was a way to like turn it on and off, like a switch, then maybe it'd be kind of cool to be able to smell a little bit and see what people are talking about before I turn it back off.
That would be really cool. We need to get electronic noses invented so that we can still experience them, like similar to a cochlear implant for hearing loss. It would be cool to have like a nose, like an olfactory implant.
But they'd be able to like filter out all of the smell, so you can smell like certain things and not get overwhelmed by the mass amount of smell you get at once.
Yeah, that would be interesting. Maybe like thinking about like audio and volume, maybe we could like control the volume on the smell somehow.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
I don't even know the word for that. I don't even think there is a word. Let's control the level, the intensity of the smell somehow. So very awesome. So Alexandra, is there anything else that you'd like to share with listeners about yourself or about Oliver?
There is one thing I wanted to share to the people who have anosmia. Just know that you can actually have fun with it with other people. I know sometimes not being able to smell kind of can be a downer in situations, but there's a couple games I like to play with like my friends and family that I think maybe other people might enjoy too. One would be kind of just like nonchalantly mention something smells good when someone's making food or something, and see how long it takes for the other person to register what you said. And sometimes they'll go, okay, yeah, wait, what did you say? And other times they'll catch it right away. Depends on how observant they are in the moment. And the other one is my absolute favorite to do with people. Essentially, it's a game of like, what does it smell like? In which you ask a person who mentioned like a smell, say, what does it smell like? Describe it to me. And then you'll find a lot of people kind of get stumped within a minute or two, and just because they have never been asked this question before. So they have to think for it. And typically they will describe what the smell is like with other smells. And then I will end up asking, so what does that smell like? And usually let the game go on for as long as I kind of deem it fair to the other person. Because it can get kind of like long if you just keep letting it go.
Yeah, our smell vocabulary is terrible. Yeah, I have done that before, though. Like asking other people to help me understand what a smell smells like. It's really difficult to describe a smell.
Oh yeah, yes. And I think they usually end up landing like on like a food I can relate to. And that's usually when I kind of go, okay, we're done with the game, but thank you for playing. And because it's something you can like, I can taste that. So I know what, I can kind of vaguely guess what it smells like based off that taste. I know it's probably not very accurate, but at least to me, it's something that I can understand in a way. And so I always kind of find it really fun to play that game. And it makes people like really think. And it's kind of cool how to see how people can think and describe things whenever they really put their mind to it.
Yeah, I've had previous podcast guests, Frauke Gallia, and she runs Falk Aromatherapy. She actually does this series on her Instagram where she describes smells using all of the senses. So what does it sound like? What does it taste like? What does it look like? Those kinds of things. So if anyone's listening and is interested, you can follow Frauke. It's at Falk Aromatherapy on Instagram. And I love that series because, to your point, like it's really difficult for people to describe what something smells like. And she did one recently that was books. And I just thought that was so cool because I can remember, because I didn't lose my sense of smell until I was 19. So I can remember vaguely now what books smell like.
Oh, see, I'm kind of jealous. I've always wanted to know what books smell like. I love reading. I always love like actually like holding a book and reading compared to like on a phone or on a tablet.
I've always wondered.
Like, I've always, like, I don't know if you've ever done it too, just after now that you've lost your sense of smell. Have you, like, done, like, gone to smell something? Just, like, on, like, instinct, but then remember, oh, wait, I can't smell it.
Now, not so much, but in the beginning, all the time. I would do that. Yeah, in the beginning, I used to do that all the time, which it can be a little like overwhelming. But yeah, I'll actually share that with you. Just like after we're done chatting, I'll share her post with you so you can see what she said. But it is pretty cool. And one of the only people I know trying to describe smells with the different senses.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. I'd be very interested in that.
Well, perfect. Well, Alexander, do you have anything else you'd like to add?
I did want to ask you a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
So since you've become anosmic, have you noticed a decrease in your memory or like being able to recall things?
Yes, I think that I have a very bad like short-term memory, long-term memory, but I do for sure feel like I don't remember things as well as I used to. And I think it has something to do with because typically when you form memories, you will be in a place, right? So you'll see stuff, you'll smell stuff, maybe you'll taste something, and then that helps like solidify the memory. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, since I don't have the smell piece, when you walk into a room, like I don't smell cinnamon and then get memories triggered for me anymore. Maybe I see the food item and that will remind me of like, oh, cinnamon, okay, this is banana bread, I used to eat that when I was little, so things like that. So for sure, I do think that my memory has suffered since I've become anosmic, and it was a lot better before.
Yes, it's something I think I've just been more aware of since I've gotten older, is that I try to recall memories when I was younger and I go, it's not as clear as it once was, or it's harder to put me in that place. And you just have to use other kind of landmarks, usually probably sight, to kind of pull me back to where it was. And so like my parents occasionally ask me, like, do you remember this? And I'm like, you gotta give me more detail of where we were when this was, kind of things. I can't just pull it out. It's so hard just to kind of bring it back, because I don't have that anchoring point of like a smell. And so yeah. I thought it was kind of an interesting thing to kind of think of and ask you as acquired an osmic.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining me today to talk about yourself and to talk about Oliver. I'm looking forward to learning if he tackles the smoke smell. That'll be pretty interesting.
Yes, I will let you and everyone in the Congenital Anosmia group on Facebook know once he does.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you to Alexandra for coming on the podcast and sharing her and Oliver's story with us. As you heard in the interview, we recorded this conversation back during Invisible Disabilities Week. I know that many of the people I speak to who have a smell disorder believe it is a disability and that it's not taken seriously enough. So make sure to check out invisibledisabilities.org for all of the good work that they're doing in this area. You can connect with Alexandra and Oliver on Instagram. They each have their own pages, which I will include in the episode notes, so make sure to check them out and get connected with both of them. And as a side note, Oliver is truly adorable. The Smell and Taste Association of North America, or STANA, is the first patient organization focused on smell and taste disorders in the USA. To find out more, visit STANA's website online at www.thestana.org. STANA is now an official 501c3 nonprofit, so any donations you make are tax deductible. We're still fundraising to help all of us with smell and taste disorders, so please donate on our website. You can also check out the latest series of programming called STANA Live Sensory Insights on our Instagram page, where we interview people from the world of taste and smell. So visit our Instagram to view all of the previous interviews. If you have any questions or if you'd like to get involved, please visit the website or email us at info@thestana.org. Please rate, review, and subscribe to the Smell Podcast if you listen using iTunes. And until next time, have a great day.